Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a really foundational text, Montesquieu's The Spirit of Laws. It's nearly 275 years old, but honestly, it feels like the source code for, pretty much every modern democracy.
That's a great way to put it. It's not just dry political theory. Montesquieu was trying to build, essentially, a science of society. His big idea, revolutionary for the time, was that laws aren't just dreamed up or handed down.
They come from somewhere specific.
Exactly. They grow out of the very nature of a society, its culture, its climate, its history, its environment. Laws have to be relative to the people they govern.
And that's why it's still so relevant, right?
Yeah.
I mean, think about countries trying to establish democracies today, or debates about executive power, judicial independence.
It all comes back to the principles Montesquieu laid out way back in 1748. He gave us this blueprint for political liberty, which he saw really fundamentally as personal safety, security.
Okay, so before we get into the book itself, let's talk about the man. Charles-Louis de Secondat, Baron de la Brède et de Montesquieu, born 1689. Who was he?
Well, what makes him fascinating is his background. He wasn't just an academic thinker up in an ivory tower. Yes, he was an aristocrat, but crucially, he was also a lawyer.
A working lawyer.
A working lawyer, and even president of the Bordeaux Parliament. So he had this really practical, hands-on understanding of how laws and government actually worked, or, you know, didn't work on the ground.
Right. He saw the gears grinding. And didn't he start out with something quite different, like satire?
He did. The Persian Letters. It was quite witty, sharp critiques of French society through the eyes of these fictional Persian travelers. Mm-hmm. Really clever stuff.
So he had this critical edge from the start.
Absolutely. And that critical eye, that sort of empirical mindset, carried over when he shifted to more systematic work. He traveled a lot, especially to England.
Yeah.
He spent significant time there really studying their system of government firsthand.
So it's this mix, the practical legal background, the sharp satirical mind, and then this comparative evidence-based study from his travels.
Precisely. That unique combination is what allowed him to attempt something as ambitious as the spirit of laws, this comprehensive science of government, as he saw it.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. He starts by categorizing governments, right? Creating a kind of typology.
Yes. That's fundamental. He looked at governments based on two things: their nature, meaning who holds power, and their principle, which is the sort of human passion or driving force that makes that government work.
And he came up with three main types. The first is the republican government.
Right. Nature, the people, or a part of the people, hold power, principle, virtue. And virtue for Montesquieu meant something specific.
Not just being good.
No, more like civic virtue. Love of country, love of equality, a willingness to put the public good before your own private interests. Mm. He saw it as demanding, requiring constant dedication.
Tough to maintain.
Extremely tough. He thought republics were fragile, really only suited for small territories where citizens knew each other and could maintain that focus. He worried that if they got too big or too wealthy, that essential virtue would just evaporate.
Which seems like a built-in problem for larger nations then. How could a big country run on that kind of self-sacrifice?
Exactly. And that leads right into his second type, monarchy. Hmm. Here, one person rules, but, and this is key, according to fixed established laws. The principle here is honor.
Honor?
Yeah.
How does that work? I usually think of honor in terms of nobility, status, wanting distinction.
Yeah.
Doesn't that just lead to jockeying for position?
That's the fascinating paradox he observed. He argued that the nobility's very ambition, their desire for rank and privilege, their honor, actually acts as a check on the monarch.
How so?
Because they want to protect their status and their privileges, they resist the king acting arbitrarily. They defend the established laws and hierarchies because those laws protect them. So in a way, their self-interest, when channeled by the system of laws, ends up limiting the monarch's power and preventing the third type.
Which is despotism, the scary one.
The scary one. Rule by one person, based purely on their will, with no fixed laws. And the principle is brutally simple: fear. If you step out of line, punishment is swift and arbitrary. For Montesquieu, this was the ever-present danger, the state that governments decay into if their core principle, virtue, or honor fails.
So the whole challenge is finding the right structure for the right society, based on its size, its economy, its climate even, to keep it from sliding into that despotic state.
Precisely. Maintaining liberty and order, avoiding both anarchy and tyranny.
Okay, let's dive into Book 11. This is probably his most famous contribution, right? The separation of powers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is where he really defines political liberty. And it's not what some might think. It's not about doing whatever you want.
What is it then?
He defines it as the tranquility of mind arising from the opinion each person has of his safety. Basically, liberty is security. It's feeling safe from arbitrary power.
Knowing the government won't just come after you on a whim.
Exactly. You need predictability. You need to know the rules. If the state can act without restraint, you can never feel secure, never feel truly free.
And the mechanism to guarantee that security.
It's his most famous line, power should be a check to power. You can't trust anyone or any single group with absolute authority. Power needs to be divided.
Into the three branches we all learn about, legislative, executive, and judicial.
Right. Making the laws, enforcing the laws, and interpreting the laws. Montesquieu's warning was stark. If any two of those powers are combined in the same hands, especially the legislative and executive liberty, is impossible.
Because?
Because the same entity that makes potentially oppressive laws would also be the one enforcing them, with no check. And if the judicial power isn't separate, then the judge becomes the legislator or the enforcer, leading to arbitrary judgments.
And he saw this model working to some extent in England at the time.
He did. He admired the English system, the king as executive, parliament as legislative, and the relatively independent courts as judicial. It wasn't perfect, but it was the best working example he found of power checking power.
Which underlines why things like judicial independence are still such a big deal today. It's not just a technicality, it's fundamental to that feeling of safety he talked about.
Absolutely fundamental. The judiciary is the ultimate safeguard for the individual against the power of the state. But Montesquieu went further than just structures. He argued these structures only work if they fit the society.
This is where the esprit général comes in, the general spirit of a nation.
Exactly. Book 19, it's this complex blend, everything from climate and geography to religion, laws, customs, manners, history. All of it shapes a nation's unique character, its spirit.
And lawmakers have to work with that spirit, not against it.
Yes. You can't just import a system that works somewhere else and expect it to take root if it clashes with the fundamental character of the people. This leads to some of his more, well, controversial ideas today, like the climate theory in Book 14.
Ah, yes, the idea that climate shapes temperament and political systems.
Right. He suggested, maybe a bit deterministically for our tastes, that hot climates tend towards despotism. People become passive, less energetic, more willing to be ruled, whereas colder, temperate climates foster vigor, independence, a spirit more suited to moderate republican or monarchical governments.
It sounds quite dated now, obviously, but you can see him trying to find these broad, almost scientific explanations.
He was pioneering for its time, trying to link environment directly to political outcomes. And he did something similar with geography and soil in Book 18.
How did that work? Fertile land versus barren land.
Kind of. He argued that large, fertile plains encourage agriculture. Big harvests need protecting, which often requires a strong central authority, like a monarch, who can raise armies and taxes efficiently.
Makes sense. Easier to submit to one ruler for protection.
Whereas rocky, barren lands, they demand hard work, industry, self-reliance, just to survive. This fosters a spirit of independence, favoring smaller, maybe republican forms of government where people fiercely guard their local autonomy. Again, maybe simplistic, but you see the logic he's building.
Okay, so if we pull back and look at the big picture, what are the core messages we should take away from the spirit of laws today?
I think there are three huge ones. First, the relativity of good government. There's no single best system for everyone, everywhere. Good government has to be tailored, adapted to the specific context, the size, the climate, the history, the spirit of that nation.
So a warning against just copying and pasting constitutions.
Absolutely. Second, liberty is security, guaranteed by law. Freedom isn't chaos, it's safety from arbitrary power. And that safety comes from predictable, stable laws applied equally to the rule of law.
Knowing where you stand.
Exactly. And third, commerce as a civilizing force. He championed what the French called due commerce, gentle commerce. He believed trade promotes peace, requires stable property rights, and generally softens manners, making societies more moderate and suited for free government.
Interesting. Those themes definitely resonate. And the book is full of memorable lines that capture these ideas, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Some real zingers that cut right to the heart of it. The most famous, of course, power should be a check to power. That's the bedrock of checks and balances.
Simple, powerful. What else?
How about liberty is the right of doing whatever the laws permit? This really pins down that idea we discussed. Freedom exists within the law, not in spite of it.
It defines the boundaries.
Precisely. And one more, maybe a warning for legislators today. Useless laws weaken the necessary laws. It speaks to the danger of overregulation, of burying fundamental rights and duties under layers of complex, often pointless legislation.
That one feels particularly relevant sometimes. So bringing this 18th century thinking into the 21st century, how do we apply these ideas?
Well, most obviously in constitutional design. When countries are writing new constitutions or reforming old ones, Montesquieu's framework, separation of powers, checks and balances, fitting laws to the national spirit, it's still the essential starting point.
It's the manual.
It really is. And related to that, it calls for policymaking humility, especially in international development. His work is a huge caution against trying to impose standardized Western models on vastly different cultures without understanding their unique esprit general.
Respect the local context.
You have to. Otherwise, it's likely to fail, or worse, backfire. And maybe most critically today, the emphasis on judicial independence. His whole system hinges on that separate judicial power being able to protect citizens from executive or legislative overreach. It's the final guardian of that liberty as security.
Looking back on our discussion, what stands out most to you? What was maybe surprising or particularly impactful?
For me, it's the sheer scope and the methodological leap. Trying to create a science of society based on empirical observation, even with its flaws like the climate theory, was incredibly ambitious. But the core insight that effective governance demands this deep, almost sociological understanding of context that's profoundly valuable. It breeds skepticism towards easy answers.
Yeah, that skepticism feels key. What surprised me revisiting it was how much he frames freedom not as some abstract ideal, but as a practical engineered thing. Liberty isn't just wished for, it's built like a machine with carefully balanced parts. It requires constant maintenance and vigilance. It's not automatic.
That's a great point. It's fragile, and it depends on getting the institutional design right and keeping it right, a constant balancing act.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.